This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 15th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 166th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We'll keep it simple this week, folks. Here is what's on your favourite old mix-up of art and books, music and things. We'll meet Alex Beck of It's Nice That, the design and art magazine, as they prepare to publish their 2014 annual of Best Bits.
And I hope that we continue to do this to make sure that, more for reference than anything else, that we kind of make a statement in years to come that this is what a creative world looks like.
And we'll speak to the dynamic duo behind this year's must-see Christmas commercial. It's for John Lewis and it stars Monty the Penguin.
This guy was walking past and started to watch the ad, and his girlfriend said, no, don't watch it. You've got to watch it from the beginning, you'll ruin it.
Brilliant.
And it was an advert, and I was a bit like, pretty cool.
Plus, we'll investigate the Singapore Film Festival, attend an updated run of Sophocles, played by refugees, and swoon along to our live Midori House session from London via Everywhere's Cristobal and the Sea. That's all to come here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. As I'm sure you remember, last week we were sunning ourselves in Miami. Coming back to a considerably cooler London hit us hard, and so to counteract it, we decided to invite a suitably sunny-sounding band in to play for us this week. Cristobal and the Sea consists of members pulled from all over Europe, and the result sounds almost Brazilian, with bossa nova rhythms, Beach Boy-esque harmonies, and a jazz flute thrown in for good measure. They call it Tropicália Pop, apparently. The band have just released their new EP, Peach Bells, on City Slam Records, and from it, this is Disquiet. Close your eyes and pretend you're still on the beach.
To love and to be.
That was Cristobal and the Sea with Disquiet. Now, Monty the Penguin, the star of this year's John Lewis ad, has become a pint-sized icon of the small screen already. The CGI-derived snow-loving bird and his little human pal have melted the hearts of the nation and practically jammed YouTube too. Its creators, Richard Brim and Daniel Fisher of Adam and Eve DDB, join me now.
All my little plans and schemes, lost like some forgotten dream. Seems like all I really was doing was waiting for you.
It came from a discussion we had. It was the very last script we'd written. We'd written, I don't know, 10, 15 scripts before this one. And we had this idea about a little boy and his monkey, his pet monkey that was a real monkey, but it was a pet monkey. And they were like, oh, it's not very Christmassy, is it? It's not very Christmassy. But it's a monkey and it's cute. And then I think one of us had just said, well, what about a penguin?
And it felt more Christmassy, so we thought, hang on, let's sort of cross-pollinate these two scripts.
I mean, they're snowy, they love the ice, they love the cold weather, and also amazingly cute.
Yeah.
Is there like Andy Serkis underneath underneath Gollum? Is there a real penguin doing the moves underneath this? Is there a sort of penguin actor?
No.
No, there
so
was
it's all CGI?
All CGI. Yeah. All
a lot
CGI.
Of research into how the Adelie penguins. So there's a lot of National Geographic footage taken, or sorry, acquired and studied at great length.
So you've been sort of hitting the Discovery Channel on YouTube non-stop. People
pretty
look
much
over your shoulder at your desk, and you are working, but you're just looking at a lot of YouTube of cute animals on YouTube.
The penguin was cast. It was literally, we went through every single species of penguin possible, and the Adelie was chosen because it was
a face.
Yeah, and had these white eyes that you could do stuff with.
He's sort of anthropomorphised, isn't he? He's got human characteristics.
Well, to an extent. I think how he sort of decided to go about it was not to make it too human. So we actually, what they actually did, what the guys at MPC, who were the post-production company that we used, what they did was actually built, they got an actual, how did we do it? They got an anatomical skeleton, an actual skeleton of an Adelie penguin, and actually copied it and then built all the tissue on top of that. So they actually had a...
So they played God. They built the skeleton, and then they added the fibres and
the tissue
and the muscles.
And finally the first, so that if the penguin were to look to the right and lift its wing up, it would do so in exactly the way that an actual real penguin would do it.
Already, there's a huge amount of cost and responsibility here. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, really creating, you know, creating a brand within a brand almost. It's just that Monty has become a brand in himself. I think you can buy the toy, can't you?
Yeah,
I know when
not
I first
anymore.
Clicked
sold
on
out.
It. It sold out. Okay, that's a success story already, right? Tick, done that. But I mean, you've created a brand within a brand. It's kind of an amazing thing. Do you have, at that point, this sounds like it's probably fairly early on in the process, do you have that kind of tingle where you kind of think, wow, this better work out? People better like Monty. People better like a penguin rather than a monkey.
The Monty's a brand thing really didn't become apparent until after it went out there, and people really associated the ad as Monty the Penguin and really picked up on his name. It's named after Dan's cat.
Okay.
What was there at the very beginning was it's the John Lewis Christmas ad, and that leaves you very, very nervous. Because
it's a very high bar.
Yeah, there's a high bar. And so
you're kind of opening the passing for England,
and also
aren't you?
A huge expectation. So in the weeks leading up to the release of the ad, there was stuff on people on Twitter going, can't wait for the new John Lewis Christmas ad, wonder what it's going to be, looking forward to Christmas dot when John Lewis goes on TV, all that kind of stuff. So there were
And you and Rick are sitting there kind of going, oh, I think of an idea then.
Hope people like it.
It's the story of the friendship of a boy and his penguin, and then the boy noticing that the penguin's missing something. He's missing a girlfriend, or she's missing a boyfriend, whatever it might be. And that's the nice thing. There is no product. There is no John Lewis product in this advert. And obviously we talk about Christmas ads in there, that perhaps the most sort of high production budgets, the sort of subtlest and most razzmatazzy of the adverts of the year at the same time. Was there ever any idea to include anything John Lewis-y in it? Or is the brand of John Lewis at Christmas this idea of love, this idea of togetherness? Is that simply what the brand has become?
The brief every year is thoughtful gifting. That's it, basically. So how
is that why you came in with 24 Stella for me?
Yeah. Thank you. Very, very thoughtful. It was a gift and it was thoughtful.
It was.
So that's the brief every year. So every single ad that has ever, that for the last 5 years, has been written around thoughtful gifting, and that's all they want. That's what they want John Lewis to be about. That's what they want the brand to stand for at Christmas.
Yeah, they want a story that will revolve around thoughtful gifting and will move people and have an emotional sort of punch.
It's an advert with a lot of cuts in it. How much stuff that you shot, that you made, bits of script, are on the cutting room floor? Because it's a two minute piece of TV, isn't it?
Not much.
Not a lot.
Pretty much.
Two scenes.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So it's
because you had to plan.
And that's exactly storyboarded out, and you know everything that's going to happen.
I mean, the director is a guy called Dougal Wilson, who's shot a lot of the ads before, and he works it out to within an inch of its life before we even turn over. And he has this book the size of my head, like a huge book. Full of...
There's a very lo-fi sort of animatic
involving
his drawings, so he knows exactly what's going to happen at each second, and then as he shoots the ad, he starts like comping together real stuff he's shot with the actual storyboard he's made, so he starts working it out exactly what we need.
But it was a strange one, more than any other job we've done, because obviously we saw all the footage and we saw the edit pretty soon after we shot, but we didn't see the penguin. And that was the bit that was the most nerve-wracking.
Yeah. And also on the shoot, we're shooting with a five-day shoot with no penguin in it, because obviously the penguin's being built, and the penguin is the star of the show.
That's very strange, isn't it? So casting the boy was the thing then. That he's kind of... His ability to act with nothing is pretty amazing.
Occasionally
penguin. What did you have in... Did you have a toy penguin?
Occasionally a toy penguin.
We had an old taxidermy penguin as well, yeah.
Yeah. So he's acting,
on wheels.
But, on wheels.
Yeah.
Spooky. Quite spooky.
That was more for the rehearsals. Then they pull it out because obviously wanted a shooting. They needed the space to put the penguin in and stuff. So
I mean, it's a beautiful piece of work. How do you know if it's been a success other than the fact that there are no more furry Monties? And that's not a euphemism. Kicking about at John Lewis HQ. How do you know if it's reached the peaks?
I had a moment when I went down to the store and people were... There's a big sort of display there. And I was there with my kids and this guy was walking past and started to watch the ad, and his girlfriend said, no, don't watch it, you've got to watch it from the beginning, you'll ruin it.
Brilliant.
And it was an advert, and I was a bit like, oh, it's pretty cool. And it's the first ad we've done where my parents now know what I do. Now they're very proud, and we'll tell people in the hairdresser.
And also there's also the 100 odd spoofs out there.
These are the two testaments to the success of it, the spoofs and people that don't know what you do knowing what you do.
And the spoofs came out on the day that by lunchtime of the day we launched it. So,
well, it's a strange measure of success, but nonetheless we know what you mean. I mean,
have you seen the Geordie one?
No, I haven't.
The Geordie one's amazing.
It is.
I'm
going to
go up to my desk in a minute and download it.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think also sabotage
that and put it straight into the John Lewis stream.
Yeah.
Well, there we have it. As ever, thank you very much for joining us.
You're
Richard Brim and Daniel Fisher from Adam and Eve DDB, the geniuses behind John Lewis's Monty. Thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's a briefing every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. When Singaporean films make headlines around the world, it's often because they've been banned under the country's rigorous censorship laws. But beneath those headlines, the artistic landscape of film in Singapore and Southeast Asia is brimming with a rich and diverse cinematic culture. This month, the Singapore International Film Festival returned for its 25th year, bringing the best of Singaporean cinema together with groundbreaking films from the region and around the world. Sarah Savage attended the festival and joined filmmakers from Singapore and beyond in celebrating what the region has to offer.
Singapore must be one of the few places in the world where a statutory board satisfactorily completed everything it set out to do in its first 5-year plan. Yet this is what the Housing and Development Board has succeeded in doing, and the evidence of their success stands eloquently in all parts of Singapore for all to see.
That's the sound of Singapore in the 1960s, as documented in the film Three Flats by Singaporean director Lee Yuen Bin, which showed at the 25th Singapore International Film Festival this month. The film follows three single women of various ages living today in Singaporean public housing, known as HDBs, which were rolled out in the 1960s to combat the country's housing crisis. This observational documentary juxtaposes the three women's lives against the original ambitions of the country's housing scheme. Here's Lee Yuen Bin.
Maybe it's about the indirectly marginalized people, especially maybe women, women who are unmarried, who are single. For example, Ling Na is a full-time artist, a charcoal artist, so she had to choose between a career and a family. And also, she fought very hard to get her flat because she had an unstable income being a full-time artist, and arts are generally not looked high upon in Singapore. So it reveals the struggles and of getting a flat. It's tied to the flat itself.
Ladies and gentlemen, the opening film for tonight, 25th Singapore International Film Festival, directed by Ken Kwek. This is Unlucky Plaza.
Another Singaporean film, Unlucky Plaza, is the first Singaporean feature to ever open the festival. Its director, Ken Kwek, has had a successful yet tumultuous career as a filmmaker in Singapore, with his last film, Sex, Violence, Family Values, being banned by Singapore's Media Development Authority in 2012. Singapore has strict censorship regulations that have made headlines across the globe, and Ken experienced this directly with his last film. Fortunately, the censorship headache he endured wasn't repeated with Unlucky Plaza, which premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in September and opened Singapore International Film Festival this month to a warm reception. Centred on the protagonist Onassis Hernandez, a Filipino single father living in Singapore whose restaurant business is failing, Unlucky Plaza examines its character's various systemic frustrations.
Everything here is clean. Everything works. I don't have to worry about you taking the bus. The roads are smooth, traffic is great. Oi! Are you driving a car or a turtle?
Here's Ken Kwek.
It's not easy to make a Singapore movie, I think, because it's an incredibly complex society and you've got to obviously pick your topic. Unlucky Plaza is sort of a culmination of seeing a particular idea of my homeland being slowly, not disintegrating in a bad way, but simply unraveling, because that's the nature of change and that's the nature of political and social liberalization, whatever you call it. Someone was always saying you can't do this or you can't be that. This is the society that I've grown up in. So now, you know, if you've got the opportunity, I would raise those questions. We have stories to tell, you know, let's put it on screen.
Yuni Hadi is the festival's executive director, and she sees the festival in Singapore as a place for filmmakers from all over the world to come together and find common ground through their art.
On an international spectrum, it actually brings together people from different countries and they find sort of a common ground based on perhaps the films that are coming out during that time. And this has really helped the Southeast Asian films, mainly because in the last 10 years, there has been a lot of interest in Southeast Asian films around the world. We saw the new waves of like Thai films and Malaysian films and Indonesian films. So all these filmmakers came out at the same time and they met at film festivals, at the same film festivals, because their films were traveling, you know, to Rotterdam, to Singapore, to all these film festivals, and sort of a friendship and community has been formed. And what we see now is over time, the benefit of what that networking and community can bring.
This year, the festival's filmmaker in focus is up-and-coming Egyptian filmmaker Ahmad Abdallah, whose debut film Heliopolis made waves in 2009. Four of his films showed at the Singapore International Film Festival, including his latest effort, Decor, an homage to vintage Egyptian cinema, which is also his first big budget production.
When I screen in cities like Toronto or like London, the amazing thing is you see films from all over the world, and the audience is very mixed also. So I'm very happy to screen the film for such mixed audience and know the opinion of people from many cultures. But here, because also it is a very mixed culture, and but still it is Asian, and it has very unique characteristics. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was very important to be here. It was very important actually to have this dialogue with the audience.
And that's the essence of the Singapore International Film Festival, right in the heart of Southeast Asia. Underneath the headlines focusing on censorship and other issues the country's art scene faces, which aren't to be understated, there is a cinematic community in Singapore that has a serious place on the world stage. For Monocle in Singapore, I'm Sarah Savage.
Thanks, Sarah. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll meet one of the men behind an annual that celebrates all things rather nice. We'll have a listen to artist David Shrigley's latest venture into music, and we'll be getting Greek at the theatre in Beirut. That's all here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. But first, another song from this week's Midori House session with Cristobal and the Sea. In a moment, we'll hear the band speak to producer Holly. But from the new EP Peach Bells, here is Violet Tear.
Jamais pica a flor a ser tu ser. Se pica a flor e me chamais, se pica a flor e me chamais, pica a flor a ser tu ser. Me resta agora saber se no nome que me dais meter a flor que guardas. Passarinho melhor. Se me das e te falo, se me das e te falo, se me das e te falo.
Cristobal and the Sea, a very warm welcome to the Culture Show here at Midori House. That was such a wonderful session. Thank you for bringing a little ray of sunshine into the studio on such a cold, cold day.
Our pleasure.
Makes us sound quite godly.
So let's maybe start from the beginning. You met at university, I believe.
Yeah.
And you all come from all over the place, Portugal, Spain, France, UK.
Yeah.
How does that feed into your music?
Well, João clearly has a lot of Brazilian influences in his guitar playing.
And we're slowly ironing that out until we sound nothing like it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the biggest part of it is that we do try and write lyrics in Spanish or Portuguese or even French every now and then, you know, just to sort of bring that element, you know, like into our music. But that's the only thing I can think of, really.
One thing we should say is that the performance you just did out in our event space, you were all sitting on the floor. Is that something you do at all your gigs?
It's something that we used to do all the time, John and me. And then even he sometimes wants to even like play on the floor when we play like full electric shows. But we just don't allow him.
But then how does that feel when you're lower down than the audience and they're all kind of bearing down on you? Is that not a bit intimidating?
It's cozier in a stranger.
And mate, I think acoustic shows are supposed to be more kind of reciprocative.
Felt a bit like jabbing around a campfire, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That's the spirit.
So you have worked with Rusty Santos, who produced your record.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. How did that come about? Because he's worked with people like Animal Collective, and you can draw some similarities between you, perhaps. How did that come about?
My biggest cosmic form of luck and serendipity ever occurred in our lives. Basically, in two separate strands, independent of each other, in one circumstance, we said, oh, like, if we could have anyone, then this guy would be good. And then separately, concurrently...
This was said to the label.
Yeah, and this was said to the label. Then concurrently, with some other people helping us out, our publishers, they then came back and were like, oh, yeah, we sent some couple of messages over to America and said if there'd be anyone that'd be interested. Okay. And they've come back with this guy called Rusty Santos. And we were like, okay, well, after
we'll take it.
If we've said that and then now this has happened, then we have to.
During a lunch, we mentioned Rusty Santos. Then it actually happened.
Yeah, it was weird.
And so what was working with him like then? What was the process?
It was incredibly...
Original?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, we didn't even record that much at all. We would spend at least 3 or 4 hours every day just talking and listening to music. Because the instrumentation was recorded live. I think no track has more than 3 or 4 takes max. So it was just like, you know, like, okay, now the vibe is right. Go, guys. Yeah. You know,
he works very fast and he's all about kind of keeping the energy and the vibe. And he's really good at knowing when the time is and when the time isn't.
Those were the voices of Cristobal and the Sea, and that new EP, Peach Bells, is out now on City Slang Records. Now, Just Who might be a print brand that has its roots in 2007, that loves paper, is famed for design, makes the cutting edge look blunt and is loved and copied across the board, and has since expanded online to live talks and events and hardcover books. Well, there's more than one of us, cats. It's nice that the design, art and general ephemera magazine, dreamt up by graphic design students Alex Beck and Will Hudson, has just published its new annual of the best of 2014, entitled Just for Difference. Ooh, it's nice that. And guess what? It is nice. And guess what also? Alex Beck came in to say hi.
What we love about it is a nice full stop to the year, and it's a real point in the year also for us to reflect on actually what that year even looked like. And even looking at the 2012 one now is really nice kind of time capsule almost of what did 2012 look like in 2014. There's lots of dogs and cats and things like that. And you go, actually in 20 years, that's probably going to be really weird.
Lots of dogs and cats.
Yeah, but I just like that. I mean, you see...
There's a sort of post-internet art, and there seems to be lots of art that riffs on this. Like Corey Archangel and these people riff on the most watched YouTube videos, which are all dogs and cats doing funny things and trying to make a serious point with it.
And I mean, it's not all dogs and cats, but I just think the broad themes that come out of it, we never really...
Was that just checking there? By the way, if you are thinking of buying it, it's not just dogs and cats.
Actually, if you were thinking of buying it, you'd probably more likely to buy it if it was. So.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think the point is the broad themes that happen to come out of it are really nice. And we never really think about that as we're putting it together. But at the end, especially maybe even a year on, you look at it and you go, actually, 2012 did look like X or Y. And I hark back to those graphics annuals me and Will used to look at Brighton as well, and you go, man, what did graphic design look like in 1972? It's amazing. I mean, it's just, they're so beautifully valuable things, and I hope that we continue to do this to make sure that, more for reference than anything else, that we kind of make a statement in years to come that this is what a creative world looked like.
And it's an interesting thing, because you obviously, you're graphic design nuts. That's evident from looking through the pages of all the things you do, and especially this annual that we're talking about today. You're obviously very interested in the art world. Those two things should always be pretty seriously aligned, I suppose. You know, one isn't just a fine artist, one could be a graphic. They obviously melt into each other. The world of advertising is obviously in there as well, and you guys have been put up for DNAD awards and things like that. So do you have to sort of find an editorial balance between those three things and then the dogs and the cats as well? Or do you just put in your favourite stuff and you go, oh, this year there was a lot of advertising, whereas last year there was more fine art? How do you find the editorial balance?
Something that's been key to It's Nice That since day one is this idea of breadth. We always talk about breadth. We talk about, just because we were graphic designers doesn't mean we're not interested in illustration and architecture and advertising, like you say. And I think that is the thing that separates it as well from a lot of other people who are doing things in our world, that actually that breadth remains. So we are very conscious of that when we're picking. Yes, it is the best stuff, but if it was all illustration, then it wouldn't be a book of illustration. We're making sure that that breadth remains, because that's also what our audience love. They come to be surprised by something they haven't seen before, and maybe from a medium that they're not exposed to every single day. And we need to keep that, and we're desperate to keep that across the books, across the website, across the symposiums, across everything that we do. That breadth is what keeps it really interesting for us, I think.
You're obviously big fans of paper, of print, of cracking the spine on a magazine or on this hardback book that we're talking about today. And you've moved offices. You've obviously invested in bricks and mortar as well. Do you see that as the future, or do you see people like us as an anomaly, maybe? Or do you feel that you've got to put your money where your mouth is and rent a decent space for people to work in so that they'll do their best?
I think what is never, ever, ever not going to have value is quality. And I believe that the quality of being in a good office where we can talk to each other, we can collaborate well, we can break away from our space, and the quality that you can show in print, especially of long-form journalism, of in-depth articles, that for me is the absolute key. It happens that manifests itself as bricks and mortar and paper, but for us it's about quality of content, which we feel like we can deliver extra quality in certain areas if they are physical. So I think that's what we really look at. But moving space, having been, because me and Will started it a little while ago now, I never really realised that we needed a nice office. We perched on the end of the desk, and who cares? You know, what are you whinging about? We don't have any windows. Who cares? I mean, come on. This is a complete lack of commitment. And then you move and you have windows and you have desks. And
this is amazing.
Oh my God, this is brilliant.
There are birds, there's a sky. Yeah.
And to be fair, I think, I mean, we had windows and desks before, but actually having proper 3,000 square foot with 25 people in it making amazing stuff is an absolute joy to behold. I absolutely love it. I didn't realise what an impact it would have on me. I just thought everyone was whinging, but sorry to everyone.
And before we go, let's take it back to the book itself, to the 2014 annual. People always hate doing this, but all the listeners always want to know why they should buy this book, why they should have it recommended. What are a couple of the things that stand out as being examples of the quality of 2014, but also things that sort of sum up what It's Nice That is all about?
I think, I mean, the guys who designed it, Studio McGill in Brighton, did the most fantastic job. And in some of their promotion on the website that they've done for the site, they charted really what was in it. And it's 142 projects, 308 pages, 7 magazines, 50 profiles, 14 exhibitions, 15 graduates. You know, I think that almost sums up what we're doing. It's nice that there is breadth and there is depth, and there's a whole load of stuff going on. And what I also love about it, and I mean, I was flicking back through it again this morning, is that I'm amazed how many kind of not huge names there are in there. I mean, I was discovering people this morning, and that for me is amazing. And I'm in it every single day, and I'm still discovering that, oh, I didn't know they did that. Or actually, I don't recognise that name, but I love that bit of work. And I think there's an element of discovery we try and hold close to It's Nice That the whole time. And I think that this does it as well as anything. I could have missed half those articles online when they went up, but it's another chance to revisit them. And also, I think the postcard, we've put a limited
edition. Yeah, talks about the front cover, because that's lovely. Each one has got an edition of 50. Tell us about it. I've got something that looks a bit like a, he looks like he might be, he's a bit Michael Craig Martin-esque.
Exactly
chap,
right. So yeah, so basically we've put 50 of the artists who are in the book. We've done a postcard of one of their bits of work. It's an edition of 50. We sent them around the world to those artists to get signed. They sent them back. And then every single book has a limited edition signed postcard on the front of one of the artists inside it, so that it can also live beyond the shelf gathering dust in 2017. Actually, you might have decided to get that postcard framed, and it lives beyond that, and more people can see it. It's another way, really, of us. We got taught by a guy called George Hardy, the most amazing graphic designer, part of Hypnosis and all those Pink Floyd covers, and he always taught us an amazing workshop just one day about adding value to things. How do you make something that you spent less than £5 on cost more than £5, was his project for us. And we've always, that taught me more than anything really at university, and we've always tried to add that to our publications, whether that's numbering or additioning or a special thing, or you get a poster with it. And I think that for, I mean, a whole load of effort, yes, loads of logistics, and Joe in our office has spent yonks chasing up artists to get signatures back. That extra effort is something that, as an independent company, without investment and without shareholders and without an FD going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
That we should continue to do, and is the magic, really.
That was Alex Beck, director of It's Nice That, and the annual is out now. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. David Shrigley is the Glasgow-based visual and spoken word artist whose daydream-like melding of random mental imagery mostly belongs in the realm of either not quite right or truly unsettling. And yet Shrigley's unassumingly deadpan delivery means his work also stays on the right or wrong side of funny at all times. The Turner Prize-nominated artist has a new album of spoken word pieces set to music out this week, named, suitably enough, Music and Words, which was created with the help of Malcolm Middleton, one half of Scottish indie type's Arab Strap. Monocle's Tom Hall went to meet David recently to learn a little bit more.
Help me please, I'm sinking in mud. Help me please, I'm sinking in mud. Help me please, help me please. I'm covered in blood.
What normally happens is I write some words, often with an actor in mind. I have a few friends who are actors up in Glasgow, and we just go into the studio. I think all but three of the tracks on this album are with one, using one actor, who's kind of a man of many voices. There's this guy called Gavin Mitchell, who's quite a well-known comic actor in Scotland. The great thing about working with Gavin is you can say, I'll do that like Richard Burton, and then he'll do it like Richard Burton, or do it as Sean Connery or whatever. So he's very versatile. So you can ask him to do things, ask him to sing a song in a sort of very jaunty way, and then you can ask him to do it in a very somber, sinister way, and he'll do both things. So quite often we had several different takes of things that I would pass on to Malcolm. I think with that particular one, the caveman song, Malcolm had put together the longer musical piece, and I kind of felt like the words maybe got a little bit lost in it, which in a way was why I decided to go back to this kind of slightly daft sing-song version. So in a practical way, that's what it was for, so that you would understand the narrative. But then again, also, I was slightly worried that it has a slightly misogynist tone to it, which I'm not very comfortable with. I say it wasn't what I intended, but I never have any idea what I intend with these types of things. So, yeah, maybe it just sort of sweetens it a little bit somehow and makes it acceptable.
He's sitting in a cave, chewing on a bone. He's sitting in a cave, chewing on a bone. In a cave, chewing a bone. In a cave, chewing a bone.
You're talking about Malcolm's input there. I mean, he's obviously a huge part of this album. I think I read that the album actually is sort of almost 7 years of collaboration, is that right? Is it a very slow process, or do you actually get together in a room and sort of discuss this and make it together in a day, or how does that work?
Well, it's perhaps a misnomer to say that it was a 7-year artwork, but then again, we'd started it 7 years ago, and it sort of happened by accident, really. I guess he cottoned on to the fact that I was very keen on his music, and he asked me to do a record cover for him. We kind of became friends and kept sort of chatting and hanging out occasionally, and Malcolm asked me to do some artwork for his website a couple of years after the album cover. And then I just made my first spoken word record at that point, which would have been 2007 or something, and I said, oh, rather than pay me, will you do a track for the next spoken word record? So I guess that's sort of where it started, really. And then Malcolm got quite enthusiastic about it and said, oh yeah, let's do an album. So it sort of evolved.
Last Wednesday, I was at home, and I was looking out of the window, and I saw a man walking past our house. He didn't have any clothes on, but he was wearing a pair of Wellington boots.
When you're listening to the songs, I mean, obviously, it's a spoken word album over music, and the words are going to have this rhythm and they're going to fit either nicely or not nicely, depending how you want it. In the very practical sense of that, I know it's kind of like an overused question, like what comes first, the music or the words? But to get that kind of sort of verse-like structure out of these readings that people are doing, are you having to sort of, is that just the magic of the editing suite, or are you getting to have, you know, when the music arrives, are you like, oh, well, this just completely doesn't work, can you re-record it to make it work? How does that work?
Well, initially, Malcolm gave me some instrumental tracks to work with, and that was actually quite difficult. And then I ended up just recording some voice without the music and giving them back to him, and eventually he kind of went back to the tracks he'd already done and put them together. But then at one point I decided to try and make or to record the words with a metronome so that they all had a beat to them. So I did a sort of 4-4 beat and whatever, various different tempos, and that's how we managed to make some of them sound quite uniform and sound like song based more so than spoken word.
That was artist David Shrigley speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. Music and Words is out now, and after the break, we're going to the theatre. Stay tuned.
The Biennale Intérieure is a furniture fair with a difference. Every year, the Flemish city of Kortrijk plays host to a design extravaganza that is as cultural as it is commercial. Monocle's David Pleasant chronicled on film this trade fair that is anything but run-of-the-mill.
This year, the Biennale was guest curated by influential critic and design practitioner Joseph Grima, who provocatively chose to question the role of design. The home does not exist is the fair's byline, and the need to question, investigate, and reinterpret is visible throughout the Biennale.
You can watch David's report, along with over 400 more films and slideshows, by heading to monocle.com and just click play.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. What happens when you mix female Syrian refugees, theatre, and the ancient Greek tragedy Antigone? Well, one production company has been causing an enormous stir by doing just that in Beirut, staging a bold reinterpretation of the Sophocles classic through the eyes of some of Lebanon's most disenfranchised. Venetia Rainey finds out more.
It's a warm December night in Beirut, and more than 100 people have crowded into the lobby of Hamra's retro Medina Theatre. Chatting excitedly, they trade information about what they are about to see, a reinterpretation of Sophocles' Greek tragedy, Antigone. The twist? The entire thing is performed and retold through the eyes of 21 female Syrian refugees, as director Omar Abu Saad explains.
Yes, I think this play is so different because we concentrate more on the play from the eyes of the refugees. I mean, we didn't want to make the ancient text. It wasn't any important for us. What was important for us really is the women, their stories, their experiences, their feelings, and to try to put this on the stage. That's what makes the whole difference.
More than 1 million refugees have been displaced into Lebanon by the Syrian civil war, and nearly all have seen or experienced horrific things. From the search for a kidnapped brother amid airstrikes to daily life in Lebanon's refugee camps, the cast's stories revolve around their experiences of the last few years and are both raw and intensely moving. Part drama therapy, part interactive theatre, the series of monologues and Greek tragedy choruses make for a clever and utterly unique show. In order to create the unconventional reinterpretation of Antigone they were looking for, the team behind the project, Aperta Productions, had to take an equally unconventional approach to rehearsals, as co-producer Hal Scardino explains.
We started the process, the workshops, by the women, first of all, getting to know one another. This was done with kind of typical theater games, musical chairs, trust exercises, consensus exercises. And then they started to sit around and discuss their personal stories and why they were here, how they got here, what they've left behind in Syria. Then Omar, the director, and Mohammed, the dramaturg, introduced the original text of Antigone. And they started to talk about it and started to discuss which characters they identified with, if any, whether they saw any parallels in the story to their own stories and what's happening today in Syria. And some pretty interesting things came out of that conversation.
Like what? Can you give me any examples?
Well, for example, we predicted this would happen, but the parallels that exist between this play written over 2,000 years ago and the women's stories in Syria today are kind of pretty shocking, uncanny.
That, of course, is exactly why Aperta Productions chose Antigone. The ancient Greek play follows Antigone's struggle to give her dead brother a proper burial, despite it being banned by a wrathful king. Her refusal to back down over what she believes to be right results in the death penalty, which in turn threatens to tear apart both family and society. Director Abu Saad explains why the text resonated with his cast.
You know, the whole background of this play is a civilian war between two brothers who killed themselves. And also in Antigone, you realize that the difference between right and wrong is not that clear. You cannot recognize it easily. Also, the main character, Antigone, who protest against political and social authority was so important for the women themselves, most of them saw herself on Antigone.
Sitting behind a desk under a single spotlight, Mona is the show's eloquent narrator. She reads excerpts from a diary she kept over the last few months about her thoughts on her fellow cast members, the play, and of course, her relationship with the protagonist, Antigone. Co-producer Scardino again.
Mona often says, she's like, I don't know if we're strong like Antigone. I don't know if any of us truly are Antigone. Is this an ideal? Are we not supposed to reach this? Or are we weak and do we need to do more?
As Mona's diary shows, the play is not just about the Syrian women getting to grips with their horrific past and their new futures as refugees in Lebanon. It is also about the challenge of taking on theatre, a totally new experience for all the women involved. I caught up with Mona in the excited aftermath of their first performance to ask her how she found it all. She told me that the experience had been wonderful, utterly fantastic. The only problems she experienced, she said, were at home as she tried to explain the point of the play to her friends and family. When I asked her if she managed to resolve the question of who amongst them was Antigone, she laughed and told me that now she realized that they were all Antigone because they had all overcome challenges to put on this performance. The only thing she wanted now, she said, was for those coming to see the show to change their image of Syrian refugees, to see that they are strong and capable. In the face of so many stories of ordinary women dealing with war, death, displacement, and loss, it would be very hard to conclude that these women are anything but strong. These women, and thousands of other Syrian refugees like them, are modern-day Antigones, and yet there is no Sophocles to immortalise their bravery, their tokens of resistance. At least here, in the echoing darkness of a Beirut theatre, their voices can be heard, loud and clear. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks, Venetia, and that is all for this week. You've been tuned into Culture. With me, Robert Bound, my producer was Holly Fisher, who, far from going on strike after the Sun in Miami, has doubled her work rate. That's the last foreign trip to the Sun you get, Holly Fisher. I'm only joking, of course. Time for one final song from this week's Midori House session. Here are Christabel and the Sea with Counting Smiles. Thanks for tuning in. Da-da, da-da, da-da.
when the smiles and tears of the night be done, when the sun outshines the neon light, you'll find me counting the smiles and tears of the night. Sun outshines the neon las cosas.